Peterborough, England. Patrick is well known to many of us. He has worked as a partner with this congregation in sharing the gospel and training people to do it in England for a number of years. He made a great presentation in our Bible class this morning, and some of you got to know him a lot better at that time. For those of you who didn't, his relationship with the Estes Church has been in place since 1981, when our brother Hogan went, who was a preacher here at this time, and met him. He had just very recently obeyed the gospel at that time. Since 1984, this congregation has been involved in the work in a direct way there. We've gotten to know his family, his good wife June, who passed from us a number of years ago. His children, Shanae, Aubrey, and Rochelle, we've seen them grow up through the reports that we've gotten from him through the years. These days, he, among other things, directs the British Bible School in Corby, England, where he has worked for a number of years now, again, helping to train not only preachers, but all Christians who are willing to do so, how to grow and develop in their lives of faith and to make a difference in the kingdom of God. We're delighted to have him with us today. He made his report in our Bible class hour, so this hour he's going to preach. We're looking forward to hearing your message, Brother Patrick. Thank you for being here.
Good morning. My name is Patrick, and in addition to being a granddad, Mark, you didn't mention my granddaughter. In addition to being a granddad, I'm also one of life's strugglers, but I have found the one who enables me in my struggles, who by his grace strengthens me in my weakness, and by the cross gives each one of us victory. And we're here because we found something compelling about Jesus. We've come to see him as our teacher, the one who teaches with authority, the one who has a real insight into life and people, and where so many insist on rules and regulations and rituals. Jesus taught that it was all about relationships, the relationship that he seeks us to enjoy with our Father and the relationship that we enjoy with each other. And so the teaching of Jesus encompasses every facet of life. His teachings don't only simply tell us how to get to heaven, as it were, but they teach us how to live the way that God intended, that we might walk with him in life. And it's only by walking with him through this journey we call life that we have the assurance of walking with him through eternity. So there are no quick fixes. There's no short list of essential steps, no tick boxes to complete, as it were. Relationships don't work that way. And we see that so clearly in many of the stories that Jesus told. So let me begin by telling you one of those stories. There was one who had two sons. And the younger one said to him, "Father, give me my share of the property now." So the man divided his property between his sons, and after a few days, the younger son sold his share of the property, and he left home with the money. And he went to a country far away where he wasted his money in reckless living. He spent everything that he had. And then we're told a severe famine spread over that country, and he was left without a thing. And so he went to work for one of the citizens of that country, who sent him out to his farm to take care of the pigs. I wish they could have filled himself with the bean pods that the pigs ate, but Nobody gave him anything to eat. So at last he came to his senses and he said, all my father's hired workers have more than they can eat. And here I am about to starve. I will get up. I will go to my father and I will say, Father, I have sinned against God and against you and I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired workers. And so he got up and he started on his way back to his father. Well, he was still a long way from home when his father saw him, and he was moved with compassion, we're told. And his father ran to him, and he threw his arms around his son, and he kissed him. Father, the son said, I've sinned against God. I've sinned against you. I'm no longer fit to be called your son. But the father called to his servants. He said, hurry, bring the best robe, put it on him, put a ring on his finger and shoes on his feet, and then go and get the prize calf and kill it, and let us celebrate with a feast. For the son of mine was dead, but now he is alive. He was lost, but now he is found. And so the feasting began. Well, in the meantime, the older brother was out in the field. And on his way back, when he came close to the house, he heard the music and the dancing. So he called one of his servants and he asked him, what's going on? Your brother has come back, he said. Your father has killed the prize calf because he got him back safe and sound. The older brother was so angry, he wouldn't even go into the house. So his father came out and begged him to come in. But he spoke to his father. He says, look, all these years, I have worked for you like a slave. I've never disobeyed your orders. And what have you given me, huh? Not even a goat for me to have a feast with my friends. Oh, but when this son of yours returns after gobbling up your estate on prostitutes, huh, you kill the prize calf for him. Ah, my son, the father answered, my son, you are always here with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be happy, because your brother was dead, and now he's alive. He was lost, and now he's been found. And that is one of the most beautiful stories that ever I heard. It's a story of love and compassion and so much more. There's devotion, there's honor, there's greed, there's selfishness, there's wild living, there's hatred, there's jealousy, and there's even a little bit of sex thrown in for good measure, but you might not have noticed that. But it's a story of contrasts, from stability to desperation, from squalor to sumptuous feasts. It's got a little bit of everything. And yet for all of that, it has long worn a title that is both ambiguous and possibly even a little bit distracting. That phrase, the prodigal son, has certainly found its way into fairly common usage. But what exactly does that word prodigal actually mean? It's not exactly a word that we use on a daily basis. Well, simply speaking, it means, this has gone haywire again, hasn't it? But there we go. It's all due to the translation. Frank, I know it isn't your fault. You're doing a great job. And Mitch, you, all of you, doing a good job. It's what happens when it's translated across the pond. It does different things, and you understand, so... Well, whatever, it means wastefully extravagant, yeah. I mean, it's like when you spend money or you use resources, freely and recklessly. And that's just what the younger son did in the story. I mean, he really was, we might say, terribly prodigal. Before we immerse ourselves into some of the details of the story, let's return to the beginning of the story and take a look at the context in which it is sent. Jesus had told a couple of short stories about things being lost and then found, and then the joy which followed the finding of that which was lost. Yeah? I mean, first of all, there was a story about a sheep that was lost, and then the joy of the shepherd, which he shares with his friends and his neighbors once he's brought the sheep safely home. And then the second story was about the joy of a woman who finds a coin that she had lost, a joy which she also shares with her friends and neighbors. And the joy of the shepherd and the joy of the woman stand in stark contrast to the grumbling of the religious people who were always criticizing and finding fault with this storytelling teacher from Nazareth. You know, and as the tax collectors and the sinners, as they were gathering close to Jesus, you know, people like you, people like me, as they gathered around Jesus, the scribes and the Pharisees were kind of hovering nearby. Huh? They did that an awful lot, didn't they? I mean, this religious elite, or so they thought, they considered themselves as being so much better than everybody else. They thought that they alone were truly righteous in the eyes of God, and so they looked down upon any that had gone astray. And they looked down on Jesus, the teacher from Nazareth, because he freely entertained the company of the downtrodden, the outcast. He loved the losers. And they said of him, "This man, he welcomes sinners with them." And they saw that as a fault. Well, the acceptance of sinners and those generally looked down upon and rejected by the religious leaders is something of a prevalent theme that runs through the Gospel of Luke. And it's in Luke's Gospel alone where we find this story of the compassionate father. And it really is a beautiful story. And I think that had I have been around at the time, I might well have thought that it was being told about me, you understand. But had I have been around them, I wouldn't be here today sharing these things with you. So let's take a closer look at what's going on here. Yeah? The Jewish law required that the firstborn would receive a double portion. So the younger son, we're told that there were two sons, the younger son would receive a third of the estate. And it's likely that Jewish tradition, which was later written down in what became known as the Mishnah, it's likely that this also allowed for the father to give away the capital or the property whilst also retaining control of the income from that capital until his death. And that's probably the sort of thing that's going on in this story. Of course, it is just a story. But in order for it to, in order for the listeners to be able to identify with it, it needed to be based on some kind of credible reality. So for reasons that are yet to be disclosed, we're told that the younger son goes to his father and he asks him for his share of the inheritance. Now, it's difficult to think of this happening in any way other than that with which we might be familiar. I mean, it's unlikely that he simply handed him a check, yeah? Or that he, transferred the funds into his PayPal account. I mean, probably there was some kind of a deed. There was some kind of means of identifying who owned which property. And it's likely that this younger son took that deed, and then he sells it for cash. And the new owner would essentially not be able to actually take possession until the death of the father. And the father retained the management of the property and the use of the proceeds. But, you know, like we say, this is just a story. Okay. So the just the details of all of this, it seems evident that the son had very little regard for his family. And he was quite happy for the estate to be broken up. It seems quite evident that he had no particular regard for his own future, as he takes the proceeds of the sale and then he heads off to a distant land where he squanders every penny. And as we've already seen, he really was an exceedingly prodigal chap. A number of years ago, I set off on a journey to a distant land. I took a train from my local railway station all the way to Beijing. When I say I took a train, you need to understand that there were several trains involved, and also there was a ship along the way. But the point is, it was a jolly long journey, yeah? And it took several weeks. And I found myself an awfully long way away from home. However, I did not consider myself on that occasion to have been particularly prodigal. I mean, I had already purchased a return ticket home by aeroplane, and my temporary Oriental lifestyle was anything but extravagant. Well, of course, the same could not be said for the younger son in our story. Once he finds himself away from home, he discovers and pleasures that he had perhaps never even considered before leaving his family. And there we find him in that distant land. He squanders his wealth in reckless living. Later it would be said that he had wasted, one version says, he gobbled up his father's estate on prostitutes. I mean, what a terrible waste. His family inheritance spent on a few moments of short-lived pleasure. And you know, there's probably a lesson here for those moving away from home for the first time. Be prepared. The thing is that we are often far more vulnerable when we are in unfamiliar surroundings, you know, on enemy territory, so to speak. And the younger son certainly was. And it might also be worthwhile bearing in mind that for a Jew, the idea of a distant land was particularly significant. You see, Jerusalem was seen as the place where God lived. And so the further one went away from Jerusalem, the further away from God one became. Of course, that's not how it actually works, we understand. Jonah had shown quite clearly that it was simply not possible to run away from God. You see, wherever you go, he's already going to be there. And that's actually a jolly good thing, although some people at the time may not feel that way. But for this younger son, if he thought that he may be further away from God, the further away from home he went, then he might have found it easier to think of doing those kind of things that he would never have even dreamt of doing back home. Well, you know, things were only going to get worse. I mean, not only did he find himself destitute, but he also found himself in the midst of a famine, all alone, totally broke, among strangers in a foreign land, starving to death, ridden with shame. He really wasn't in a very good place. And with famine in the land, food prices would have gone through the roof. And the only work that he could find was feeding the pigs. I mean, for a Jew, one can hardly think of a less desirable form of employment. I mean, not that feeding pigs is necessarily everyone else's cup of tea, you know, but for the Jew, I mean, it was virtually unbearable, for pigs were considered unclean. The rabbis would say, cursed is the man who raises pigs. And so in this young fellow's mind, he may be thinking, well, what will the family be thinking if they were to know about this? And, you know, for all of this, he may have found some form of shelter, but he was still without adequate food and still without any friends, for nobody gave him anything. Is it not true that there must come a time in our lives when we realize that we are not what we ought to be. And not only are we not what we should be, we're not even what we could be. I don't know, we may not be ready to make some sort of a public confession, but when we look at ourselves in a mirror, we see staring back at us a soul in desperate need of help. We've messed up. We've wasted opportunities. We know what it is to be a loser. And for the young man in the story, that time was now. About 600 years earlier, the prophet Jeremiah had written, "Jerusalem remembers in the days of her affliction and wandering all the precious things that were hers from days of old." And now in our story, the younger son remembers. As nobody came to the help in the depths of his despair and destitution, he remembers the precious things that were from the days of his youth. And he says, "How many of my father's hired servants have more than enough food to eat? Here am I starving to death." Finally, he had come to his senses. He remembered how good things once were. And though he had no delusion that they were ever going to be quite as good again, he knew that there was more than enough to go around. And so he says, "I will get up, I will go to my father, and I will say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I no longer deserve to be called your son. Take me on as one of your hired hands.'" I mean, it really was his only hope. Well, I don't know about you, but maybe we have no glory past to recall how good things once were. Yeah? Maybe they never were that good. Maybe we have a childhood that we would rather forget. Yeah? I understand that. Whatever our past may have been, we may still come to realize that there is a life so much better than the one we have been living. There's a real hope that out of our darkness and desperation, there may still be a better life ahead. But first of all, there needs to come that moment in the mirror. You know, there's something about the rehearsed confession of the son that is particularly refreshing. There's something, there's an honesty about it that recognizes the reality of his despair. He says, "I have sinned against heaven. I no longer deserve." And the thing is that our actions always have consequences, which we may not like, but which are the result of our own stupidity. And we need to accept responsibility for our actions. In all of this, there was no attempt to blame anyone else, no excuses, simply an open heart longing once more for acceptance. And rather than try to identify all of the violations or so-called sins of which the son was guilty, as if that would even be possible, rather than try to do that, we'd be better to understand his confession as an acknowledgement that his life was simply a real mess. Whatever deeds he might have done, he had been selfish, he had been unfaithful, he'd been foolish, he'd been reckless, and probably a whole lot more besides. Because sin isn't just about breaking rules and regulations. Sin is about dishonoring God. It's about violating his trust. It's about spurning his love. It's about disregarding our fellow beings. And the thing is, all of us, we're all in this together. None of us is better than anyone else. None of us. We've all sinned, and as much as we've all missed the mark, we've all fallen short of what it is that God intends for us. My grandmother had hanging in her dining room a wooden plaque with a poem by the 19th century poet Joaquin Miller. I hadn't heard of him either. But I remember this from a very early age. Here it is. It says, you missed the, but it says, in men whom men condemn as ill, I find so much of goodness still. In men whom men pronounce divine, I find so much of sin and blot. I hesitate to draw a line between the two where God has not. And I remember every time going to her house, I wanted to read that, and I read that, and it had, I think, a profound impression upon me. And I know that this wasn't, you know, these words didn't come straight out of the mouth of Jesus, but I think they could have done. You understand, yeah? You understand the sentiment in all of this. We're all of us, we're in this together, and none of us is better than anyone else. So we're told that the younger son home. I don't think that was meant to happen. I'm not good at this, am I? Well, you know, the younger son, he returns home and he rehearses his confession and he's ready for the worst, yeah? Yeah, we might well say that he returns home, but if you look carefully at the text, the idea is more that he is returning to his father. The contrast is not so much between being at home or away, but as being away and not with the Father. I mean, you get the idea there? It's heaven's a little bit like that. Heaven is not so much about being in a certain place, but rather being with a certain one. Yeah? And it's about the relationship that we have or that we don't have with God the Father. But you know, we may digress a little there. Here's the deal. This understanding of the young returning not so much to home but to his father is brought out very clearly by what happens on his return. Jesus says that he arose and he came to his father, but while he was still a long way off, his father saw him. He had he felt compassion and he ran and embraced him and he kissed him. Huh? I mean, let's do that again, yeah? His father saw him. He felt compassion, and he ran and embraced him and kissed him. And isn't that absolutely amazing? I mean, there's no anger at what he had done. There's no criticism. There's no condemnation. There's not, who on earth do you think you are showing your face around here? There's none of that. Instead, there's compassion, and there's embracing, and there is kissing for the one who's just squandered a third of the family inheritance, brought shame upon them all, and broken up the estate. Isn't that absolutely amazing? There's a most delightful poem, a song, if you like, written by Samuel Longfellow, again in the middle of the 19th century. And it's a song about this story of the compassionate father. And I asked, and I don't know that you sing this. It's one that we sing quite a bit. In fact, I'm singing this one at my funeral. I don't have the date for that yet, but you know, if you want to come, we're going to do it then, and that, okay. That's a beautiful song, Love for All, and Can It Be? Can I Hope It Is for Me? I who strayed so long ago, I strayed so far and fell so low. It's probably in your book somewhere, yeah. I, the disobedient child, wayward, passionate and wild, I who left my father's home in forbidden ways to roam, I who spurned his loving hold, I who would not be controlled, I who would not hear his call, I the willful prodigal. To my father, can I go? At his feet, myself I'll throw. In his house, there yet may be a place, a servant's place for me. See, my father reaches out, and my father waiting stands. See, he reaches out his hands. God is love, I know, I see. Love for me, yes, even me. I like that. Love that song. And even though it's one of my favorite songs, I think it misses one significant point. That final verse there begins, oh, that's kind of missed it, but okay. That final verse there begins, see my father waiting stands, see he reaches out his hands. But that's not actually how the story goes, is it, huh? You know, Jesus said that while the young son was still a long way off, his father saw him, he felt compassion and ran and embraced him. Huh? You notice that? He ran. The father didn't simply stand waiting. He actually ran to his son, not with clenched fists, but with outstretched arms, eager to embrace him. And why does he do that? Why does the father in the story have compassion and run and embrace and kiss his son? Why does he do that? Because that is exactly how God welcomes back the one who was lost and who is now found, the one who was dead but now lives. And when I read this story, I'm reminded of the words of King David, written about 1,000 years earlier. When David, it's in Psalm 103, and David writes, "The Lord does not deal with us according to our sins, nor repay us according to our iniquities. For as high as the heavens are above the earth, so great is his steadfast love towards those who fear him. And as far as the east is from the west, so far has he removed our transgressions from us." As a father shows compassion to his children, so the Lord shows compassion to those who fear him. As a father shows compassion to his children, and yet there's so much more than simply compassion here. There's a real celebration with a ring on his finger and shoes on his feet that had been worn out from the long journey. The prize calf is slaughtered for a sumptuous feast with music and dancing. Some might almost call the father's behavior wastefully extravagant, huh? The prodigal father. You remember the lost and found sheep and the lost and found coin? Well, here is the joy in heaven before the angels of God over one sinner who repents. Here's the father expressing his joy because his child has come back to him, and no expense can possibly be spared for such an occasion as this. But not everybody saw it quite the same way. There were two brothers in the story. The attention now turns to the older of the two, the one who has faithfully stayed at home since the beginning of the story, and he knows nothing of the father's joy, but instead he is filled with anger, and he refuses to go back into the house. Even when his father came out and entreated him, he could only protest his own innocence and complain of what he saw as the unfairness of it all. I don't know, maybe he feels cheated. Maybe he feels that his father is wrong for behaving in such a fashion. After all, having spoken of the rights of the inheritance of the firstborn, the law of Moses went on to speak of a stubborn and rebellious son who was a glutton and a drunkard, and how that all of the men of the city shall stone him to death with stones. I mean, no fatted calf, no ring, no shoes, no music, no dancing, no party, just a stoning to death in order to purge the evil from their midst. It's all there in Deuteronomy chapter 21. But where the law was concerned with setting in place a moral framework, if you like, a code of civil conduct, it never excluded the possibility of one turning away from rebellion and finding forgiveness and restoration and life. That was always there from the very beginning. But there were always those who thought themselves better than others, and they would rather condemn than show compassion. And the Pharisees and the scribes were just like that older brother who knew no joy, for they knew nothing of the mercy and compassion of God. You see, when God throws a party, the religious people don't want to join in because they're so consumed by their own goodness, which isn't really goodness at all, of course, just wickedness clothed in self-righteousness. No. When God throws a party, it's the sinners who turn up. For they've come to know of God's love, have we not? And they've entered into his joy, have we not? For they were dead, but now they live. We were lost, but now we've been found. May God open our hearts to see the way clearly back to his heart. May we trust in his ways, even when we may not understand them to be fair. And may we share in his joy every time a lost one comes back to the Father. May we welcome them back into his family. There's a lot of you that I don't know yet. And we've got an eternity to sort that out, I understand. But if you need to come back to the Father, you don't need to wait any longer. You know that, don't you? He's waiting for you with those outstretched arms. He's waiting to embrace you and kiss you. And if you're not where you need to be right now, then please, please do something about it before you leave this place today. We love you. We love you because God loves you. And we're ready to embrace and even kiss you. God bless you. We're going to stand and sing a song, are we not? I don't know. It'll just come up on here, won't it? So here's a time to think of where we are and where we need to be. And don't leave here without doing something about it. Should we stand? Do you need this?